Welcome to the final lecture of this wonderful series, Meeting Points.
Thanks very much, Ursula. And just wanted to start by thanking the faculty for the invitation originally to come and give these talks, everyone for coming along to them, but also to Carolyn, particularly to Carolyn Nivellon and Sarah Hepworth, who've been sort of hosting on the admin site for this, made me feel very welcome in the faculty, and I really appreciate it. So this final lecture, so I said the last two lectures were going to be particularly about sort of moral philosophy, which is something of a new area for me, but this particular final lecture is going to be about how these points of view that I've been talking about the last few lectures treat each other and what the moral demands are on how they treat each other. I mean, to some extent, that's rather metaphorical. I'm not going to, as we'll come to see later on, I'm not someone who wants to reify these points of view. I don't want to kind of separate them out. I'm going to be thinking of persons alongside everyone else. I'm not an eliminativist about, but nonetheless, I think persons have these points of view, inhabit these points of view, have different ones across the course of their life. And I think that there's some sense, and we'll come back to maybe spelling this out in a more long-winded but less metaphysically loaded way in a little bit, I think there's ways in which there are moral constraints on how points of view or people inhabiting points of view at different points can treat themselves or others inhabiting points of view in ways that are morally significant and where morality makes demands on them. So I'm going to start. So essentially the talk is an attempt to sort of begin to get a handle on the following sort of puzzle. Might not seem puzzling to you. Originally, it puzzles me. And I want to try to persuade you there is something of a puzzle here. And I'm going to try to work through some possible ways of explaining the puzzle or accounting for the puzzle and suggesting that some of the natural ways don't necessarily work and then suggesting something else that we could try. So the puzzle is this. The first is that there are demands of what I'm calling intra-personal morality. So these are demands that concern how you, a person inhabiting a point of view, particular time in your life, behave in ways that say affect just yourself, same person, but another point of your life inhabiting a different point of view. I think that's more naturally said by saying there's moral claims about how one of yourselves treats another of yourselves. But when you start talking like that, people immediately imagine that you're going to get kind of heavy duty on the metaphysics and things, these separate things called selves, and they kind of together form some sort of corporate entity that's the person. I mean, I'm taking a kind of view that I think, and there's questions about whether Derek Parfit, who talked a lot about these things, he wanted to kind of rest too much in this metaphysics. But certainly I think quite a lot of the reaction that came afterwards, I'm thinking particularly of Susan Wolfe and Christine Korsgaard's reaction, said, although they were vehemently opposing Parfit, saying, thought that none of this depended in the end on the metaphysics. And I want to kind of take a similar view. You might think, and we can get to this in Q&A if people are interested, that I can't get away from talking about the metaphysics. But I think in the end that the issues don't rely on this. Okay, so I want to start. The first part of the puzzle is that there are some demands of intrapersonal morality. There are things that you can do, yourself now can do, that affect perhaps only yourself at a later time, one of your future selves, that count as morally wrong. Now, saying all of this sounds like sort of a bit of a mouthful, and lots of other people say these things in terms of you have duties to self, you have obligations to self, your other selves have rights towards each other. But I don't want to kind of use that sort of morally committing language or normatively committing language of duties and rights yet. We'll come later on to questions about whether some of these moral wrongs are perhaps wrongs that don't involve violation of duties, for instance. So I don't want to assume that up front. I just want to say there are certain acts you can perform now from your current point of view that affect only your other points of view or affect them mainly that are morally wrong in some way. Whether they're wrong because they violate a duty or not, I'm not saying anything about it. So that's the first thing I want to say. Then the second part of the puzzle is that nonetheless, these demands of intrapersonal morality are weaker than demands of interpersonal. That second assumption, I take it, is much less controversial. People tend to think that that there are no demands of intrapersonal morality, but it would then follow from that that certainly whatever they are, they're weaker than the demands of interpersonal morality. But so the puzzle arises from both making both of these claims. there really are claims of intrapersonal morality, but that they're weaker than the demands of interpersonal morality. So spell it out a little bit more. There's burdens that morality permits you to place, it permits me to place on myself, but it doesn't permit me to place on you. Classic sorts of examples are, it's okay for me to book a dental appointment next week to get a root canal to avoid some kind of long-term toothache, but it's not okay for me to, if this were in any way possible, for me to inflict that sort of agonizing dental treatment on you to benefit me in the long run. I take it, most people think. So it's okay for me to do that. But there's no burdens it's permissible, that morality permits me to place on you that it does not permit me to place upon myself. There's not something I'm allowed to do to you, but if it were to come to doing it to myself, it would be impermissible. That's sort of claim, but nonetheless, there are indeed burdens that morality doesn't permit me to place upon myself. So that's the kind of shape of the puzzle. And what I want to do here is sort of, I'm trying to find an explanation for why this might be so. You might naturally occur to you certain explanations immediately, and they are perhaps the ones that I want to convince you don't in fact work. So we'll come to those. Okay, but first of all, I want to do a little bit more to motivate the idea that there are indeed intrapersonal moral demands, because that's, I think, the kind of more controversial of the two parts of the puzzle. So the first thing to say is that it's something of a historical anomaly that often analytic moral philosophers don't think that there are such intrapersonal moral demands. In fact, it was a kind of standard thing for philosophers prior to the second half of the 20th century to think that they're just, to take it as kind of given that there are these sorts of moral demands. I mean, certainly, you know, when I was kind of learning analytic ethics, I was sort of taught that ethics was about treatment of others, and something like prudential rationality or something like that was the study of what we owe to ourselves, but they were different, and perhaps they have kind of different normative forces. Morality has this kind of stronger normative force than mere prudential rationality does. But that view, while it was sort of popular in the late 20th century, is historically reasonably anomalous. So I'm just going to quote a couple of passages that speak to that anomaly, and these are really coming from a great book, which I recommend for people who are interested in this topic, called Duty to Self, by Paul Scofield, and he cites these two cases. The first from Bishop Butler. Butler says, "It deserves to be considered whether men are more at liberty in point of morals to make themselves miserable without reason than to make other people so, or dissolutely to neglect their own greater good for the sake of a present lesser gratification than they are to neglect the good of others whom nature has committed to their care. It should seem that a due concern about our own interests or happiness and a reasonable endeavour to secure and promote it is virtue, and the contrary behaviour faulty and blameable, since in the calmest way of reflection we approve of the first and condemn the other conduct, both in ourselves and in others." So here, what's interesting, I think, is that Butler isn't really giving any argument that there are moral considerations to do with, you know, your own treatment of yourselves. What he's asking about is this question of degree, why it is the case that there might be kind of lesser moral requirements on our treatment of ourselves than there are on others. So what's kind of interesting here is not necessarily that he offers any argument that there are, but in fact that he doesn't. He sort of takes this as a kind of given in the argument. And then what's equally interesting is that when Bernard Williams discusses something similar, he similarly takes it as just given that there aren't such things in another context. So here's the Williams quote. "If we have accepted general and indeterminate obligations to further various moral objectives, as modern moral philosophy encourages us to do, they will be waiting to provide work for idle hands, and the thought can gain a footing that I could be better employed than in doing something I am under no obligation to do. And if I could be, then I ought to be. I'm under an obligation not to waste time in doing things I'm under no obligation to do. In this case, certainly, only an obligation can beat an obligation, and in order to do what I wanted to do, I shall need one of those fraudulent items, a duty to myself." So what's interesting here is that to Williams is kind of, you know, standard sort of Williams line that, you know, the modern moral philosophy kind of creates these sort of obligations to further certain impersonal or general goods that are incredibly demanding on us and can end up constantly kind of thwarting or overpowering our reasons to do things, to pursue our own projects, a standard kind of objection against utilitarianism and other forms of kind of modern moral theories. But what's interesting in this is, in order to argue against this, he just takes it for granted that there can be no such thing as a duty to self. And he says, we'll need one of these fraudulent items, a duty to myself. That's the only way that you could possibly save our ability to kind of act to pursue our own projects. So he's not really giving any argument for that. He just assumes that all of his readers are going to be on board with the idea there can't be any duties to yourself. So an interesting contrast between Butler, who seems to assume without argument that there are some sort of, maybe you call them duties to yourself, but at least moral demands of how you treat yourself, and Williams, who assumes without argument that there aren't, in the course of arguing for something else or better. But that's not an argument. I don't want to rest too much, and I certainly don't want to rest too much on Butler's observation that we indeed disapprove of people who don't attend, say, to their kind of future well-being or kind of are derelict in their duty towards them. Because just a mere disapproval doesn't distinguish between a disapproval because the person's being prudentially irrational and a disapproval because they're being immoral. So these aren't arguments. Okay, so moving on to sort of more arguments or at least kind of intuition pumps to get you thinking that perhaps there are duties to self. I think we can start off by wondering why people have been so convinced that there aren't such duties. So one natural sort of argument, and it sort of emerges in the mid-20th century, whether it's causally responsible for this general view that morality is really about treatment of others and something like rationality is to do with treatment of self, I'm not sure, but certainly this kind of argument emerges and is kind of considered quite successful. So it's an argument that I think is an interesting parallel with Wittgenstein's private language argument. The argument goes something like this. Look, if you had a duty to yourself, it would be impossible to violate it. Because any attempt to violate it, that is any act that you did that would be in violation of the duty, by doing the act, you would waive the duty. You had not to do the thing. So I have a duty to myself not to behave to myself in a particular way. I try to violate it by doing that thing that I'm not supposed to do, but by doing it, I somehow automatically waive that duty. In the way that, you know, you might not have a duty to kind of pinch my arm, but if I said to you, yeah, go ahead, pinch my arm, I'd have waived your duty not to pinch my arm. You would think by me doing certain things to myself, I'd automatically have waived that duty. So it looks like a kind of case where surely we can't have a duty if there's a sort of in principle impossibility in violating it. Just as Wittgenstein thinks that, well, on one controversial reading of the private language argument, I never want to say it's what Wittgenstein said, it's one possible reading of the 10,000 he might have been meaning, but one natural reading of it is something like, you know, if you had a private language, they'd have to have rules that couldn't principle be broken because by attempting to break them and use a word in a way different from the rule, you would automatically alter the rules. So it's a little bit like that. So one way to identify some sort of ways in which we can act morally badly towards ourselves is to see cases where this sort of argument breaks down. So one kind of case, which is identified by Alison Hills, is a case where it's in fact impossible to waive the duties. You have certain duties to yourself that nothing could waive. And this is because, in fact, we have duties generally to one another that it's impossible to waive. So the duty not to torture someone, the duty not to enslave someone, and other sorts of things. These are duties that you have to each other, but, and indeed you might think, therefore to yourself, but nothing you can do ends up waiving them. So your attempt to do them doesn't thereby waive it, therefore you do end up successfully doing it, you have in fact wronged yourself. That's one natural thing to think. I think that's right, in fact. I agree with that, but I don't think it covers all of the ways in which, not saying that Alison thinks it does, but it doesn't cover all the ways in which you behave morally badly towards yourself. So other sorts of cases that Daniel Munoz and Nathaniel Barenschmidt have suggested is cases in which your consent fails, and perhaps in sorts of ways that I was talking about last week, actually. So If you think that what happens when you kind of have duties towards yourself, but when you act, you thereby waive them, and that action that you kind of do that sort of attempts to violate them is somehow involves in it some sort of consent, then you might think that the consent misfires for the sorts of reasons that I was talking about last week. There's all sorts of reasons that consent can misfire. Maybe they're based on preferences formed and the sorts of problematic ways I was talking about. I think that's a much less obvious sort of case. I'm not going to talk about it too much in the interest of time, but I think it's much less obvious that this sort of thing happens. For instance, they have examples of kind of if you've got drunk, you end up kind of wronging yourselves in all sorts of ways because you're unable to kind of consent to treating yourselves in the ways that you then do. Seems much less obvious to me that that's what's going on. So I don't want to rest too much on that. Okay, so instead I'll talk about just a few other sorts of cases where I think the sorts of wrongs involved can end up, or the sorts of behaviour involved can end up sort of harming a person or burdening yourself in certain ways that don't amount to unwaivable violations of unwaivable duties, the sorts of things that Alison's interested in, but nonetheless do amount to kind of moral, morally bad behaviour towards yourself. I think very often, not always, we'll come towards the end of this list, but very often these sorts of cases are going to be ones where your treatment involves, has its effect on far future selves. Okay, so where the action happens now and it ends up affecting the kind of the burden that it imposes ends up falling on people, on a part of yourself in the far future, or falls on yourself in the far future. So, for instance, you can act now in ways that are certain or very likely to cause physical, psychological, or cognitive harms on yourself in the future. So a natural example of this is very dangerous sports, a whole series of sports, more and more of which I've learned about while thinking about this and about this alarming sports that that cause kind of long-term cognitive damage. But the cognitive damage only really appears quite a bit further down the line. This is not something that kind of immediately arises. It's just a thing to do with the sort of head injuries that you incur that mean that the damage is delayed. So that's the sort of case where you do something now, impose this really severe, in lots of cases very severe, harm later on yourself, that you might end up thinking that severity of it and the distance in time makes it such that this counts as some sort of morally wrong behaviour towards yourself, not just kind of imprudent behaviour. Other sorts of cases are ones where you don't sort of impose harms like that on yourself, but you might restrict your autonomy, for instance. You might enter into a contract that gains you some kind of wonderful benefit now, but it falls due in 20, 30 years' time, and that when it does fall due, it's incredibly onerous. Other sorts of cases are ones where you burden yourself in the future with moral obligations. So you kind of moral obligations that at the time you may not really be able to fulfill, or may only be able to fulfill with kind of enormous burden to yourself. And so you might kind of put yourself in the way of sort of moral injury, something like that. These are some, I think those kind of cases are kind of natural cases, cases where there's a kind of behaviour now that ends up having its effect far down the line. I think there are other sorts of cases that you can have as well. They're much less obvious, I think, but there might be instances of it. So I think you could end up behaving now. So all the cases I've been talking about so far are cases where I behave now in ways that affect my future selves, or harm, the burden falls on my future self. You might also think that I could wrong my past self. For instance, in my past selves, kind of have over a long period of time made enormous sacrifices in order to kind of pursue a project over a long period of time that I then later come to completely disvalue and end up destroying in a kind of fit of pique against my former self, who's kind of spent all this time, all so much of their life kind of devoted to it. You might end up thinking that something like that is immoral. And then there are other sorts of cases, I think, which are interesting, which I'm not really going to talk about at all, cases where you might think that you have a moral obligation to resist attempts to treat you badly, or at least to kind of give yourself sufficient weight when you're thinking about kind of trade-off cases with others, where there's cases where your own kind of goals are being weighed against others. And very often, think about it, for anyone who's here last week, think about these kind of angel in the house cases, the Virginia Woolf case that I was talking about last week, where someone has kind of internalized this very self-denying, kind of extreme altruist norm. You could think that that person ends up wronging themselves by not kind of valuing themselves enough. It's the sort of thing that Kantians might easily think, that you're not kind of giving sufficient value to yourself, or not kind of respecting your dignity sufficiently. So Carol Hay has a really interesting discussion of people's duties to resist oppression. A failure to resist oppression amounts to kind of not valuing yourself. Okay. And these really moral sorts of cases, one thing that sort of convinces me that something moral going on is that it looks like there's an asymmetry between cases where someone burdens themselves now in order to get a benefit later on, versus a case where they take the benefit now and predictably as a result get a burden later on. So cases where you kind of, you know, put yourself through suffering, perhaps deep boredom, perhaps frustration, perhaps kind of opportunity costs like not interacting with friends or not forming kind of close relationships in order to pursue this project, in order to get some big benefit later on. People end up kind of having a reasonably approving attitude to some of that sort of thing. Whereas if you do something now that gets you lots of benefit over the the near future, but, you know, ends up kind of placing a burden on you in the later, at a later point, people end up seeming to disapprove of that. Why would that be if all that there was going on was some sort of prudential rationality? In those cases, it looks like the weighing up of different parts of your life should be pretty equal. The cases look like they've just kind of had the kind of benefits and burdens swapped around, but nonetheless, we seem to judge them differently. And that suggests to me, at least, that there must be some further consideration going on, and I think that could easily be a moral consideration. Okay. The next section actually talks a little bit about a kind of larger project this is a part of, which is a kind of project to think about. I'm calling the units of morality. I'm not sure it's the best term for this, but I'm thinking about the kind of the items, I mean, to try to use neutral, but in the end, probably too impersonal kind of language, the items or entities in terms of which we state our general moral theories or our local moral principles. Do we state them in terms of persons, or do we state them in terms of something more like selves, something like kind of persons inhabiting a particular point of view? In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through too much of this, but I think the arguments I'm going to talk about here are going to kind of push us towards thinking of these general moral theories and local moral principles as more appropriately being stated in terms of something more like selves or persons inhabiting a particular point of view. So in that sense, I'm kind of getting at a similar sort of conclusion to the one that I take Parfit to be trying to get at with the Russian nobleman case. Example, I think it's from Tolstoy, of a kind of young idealistic socialist Russian nobleman who's set to inherit in 10 years' time some large amount of money, but he thinks in 10 years' time it's likely that he's going to have lost his socialist ideals, and at that point he'll just keep all the money for himself. So he creates this kind of complex, and the whole scenario is somewhat complex, creates this kind of complex legal instrument that means that when it comes to him inheriting it, this money will kind of automatically go to the peasants who farm the land rather than to himself. But for some legal reason, it has to be kind of get out. It has to be some way avoiding this, and that's going to be his wife has the ability to avoid this this legal instrument. So he includes this, but he asks her to promise him that she won't void it, even if he desperately begs her to. And right enough, 10 years pass, and he does lose all his socialist ideals, and now he does, in fact, he inherits the money and he wants to pass it on to himself to buy, you know, sorts of paintings of himself and so on. So he asks his wife, he said, well, you're the only person who has the legal possibility of voiding this, and she says, no, I promised you that I wouldn't. He said, yes, but, you know, it's always okay for a person to then, you know, release you from a promise. And she said, yeah, but, you know, you're not the person I made the promise to. In some sense, you're not the person I made the promise to. So I take it what's going on with the Parfit case there is he's trying to argue that these some sort of principle concerning when promises are still binding after a period of time should be stated not in terms of persons, stated in terms of whole persons, then that gets this case wrong, but in terms of something like self. You could think, well, that argument just kind of establishes that, so nothing more to say. But I think one problem with this argument is that people's reaction to it really changed depending on the kind of moral status, the moral direction of the Russian nobleman's travel. If he starts off as the person who wants to take the money all to himself and makes the wife promise that she won't void it, even if he becomes a socialist later on, people have very different reactions. It really seems to be tracking just whether you kind of think the socialist is the right thing to do. Okay, so it shares something in common with what Parfit's doing. Also shares something in common, I take it, with the kind of moral view that Monima Chadha and Sean Nichols have been kind of working out over a series of papers that kind of look at the in the Buddhist context, how you might kind of gain moral principles when, I mean, this is a more extreme version of kind of no, or moving from the person to an even less committal kind of metaphysics, but it's a similar sort of view to that, I take it. Okay, so let's try and give some explanations of what's going on in these cases. So one sort of account I think that naturally occurs is that what's going on in these cases where it's kind of, you know, possible to wrong myself, kind of naturally falling into the wronging myself language, I'm not meaning the kind of strong sense there, but the kind of behave morally badly towards myself. It's possible to do that, but it's less easy to do that just because it's easier to gain consent from yourself to do certain sorts of things. It's not always possible. Alison's unwaivable duties case show that, and maybe there's other sorts of cases as well. But nonetheless, it's easier to do it, and that explains why there's this asymmetry between myself and other people. It's easier for me to get consent to myself that waives these duties than it is to get it from others. Easier we'll come on to that. So there's a kind of interesting line from this book by Paul Scofield that I was talking about that suggests something like this. He says, it's only natural that Kant became the modern era's most forceful defender of duties to the self. For Kant, wrongful action most often stems from an impulse to make an exception of oneself. And so you might naturally think that a Kantian is going to take the view that you must think that you have similar sorts of duties, perhaps even exactly the same duties of yourself as you have to others, because to think anything else is to make an exception of yourself. And that's exactly the sort of situation that Kant thinks, where morality, where people kind of go wrong. And indeed, this is sort of the view that Daniel Munoz and Nathaniel Baron-Schmidt end up taking. So they have this thing they call the self-other symmetry. One has exactly the same basic rights against oneself as one has against anyone else. But they think, sort of, that seems extreme, a very extreme view. Surely I don't have all of exact, you know, I have a right against you that you don't kind of pinch my arm, you know, to do this without anyone kind of accusing me of some deeply immoral action. Well, that's fine because it turns out that I end up kind of waiving that that right in lots of cases. Okay, so this would clearly sort of explain the puzzle if it were to work, okay? Because it would of course give the possibility of behaving morally badly towards yourself, but it would also kind of give the asymmetry where the moral demands on your behavior towards yourself are weaker than the moral demands on behavior towards others. Not because they're actually the fundamental ones are weaker, they're exactly the same because of this self-other symmetry, but because it's in fact much easier for you to get consent. And so in a lot more cases, you're able to do things you wouldn't be able to do to others. So one worry that naturally comes up when you think about this is, in fact, you don't go around consenting to yourself. You don't obtain consent from yourself very often. You don't, you know, at almost every point during this talk, I was sort of doing something, you know, kind of clasping my hands, touching, you know, my body in sorts of ways that would be kind of violations to myself. At no point did you hear me sort of whisper to myself, you know, may I do this? Yes, or something. Yes, you may. Okay. So what's how do we resolve this kind of problem? One problem is, one response is to say something like, well, no, it's true that you don't, in fact, get consent from yourself, but you nonetheless are better able to predict that you would get it were you to act. You say, yeah, okay, I don't in fact consent in all of these cases, give explicit consent, but it's easier for me to predict that I would give consent than it is for me to predict that others would give consent. I think a big problem with that is that this just isn't how we treat consent in interpersonal cases. It's not okay for me to do something to you just if I predict that you'd be okay with it. It's not okay for me to just kind of, giving examples last week, just kind of go and sleep in someone else's flat just because I thought that were I to ask them, they would say it was okay. That doesn't seem how it goes. The other problem is that we aren't particularly good at predicting whether we would in fact give consent in kind of far future cases. We don't really know what our far future selves would be. So the answer that Munoz and Baron-Schmidt themselves give is that what happens, so This is kind of comes back to something I said at the beginning last week, that there's a growing consensus, I think, in the consent literature that people have put a lot, far too much weight on explicit acts of consent. And while these are sort of important in very certain legal contexts, like, say, taking property, large pieces of property or expensive pieces of property, and sexual consent, and informed consent in the medical context, and certain sorts of things, in fact, most of what happens in our day-to-day interactions is nothing like, you know, explicit requests for consent followed by explicit granting of consent. There's all sorts of other things that we do. And one thing that's been pointed out when, in the sexual consent case by John Gardner is that you might think that something similar to consent happens when you embark willingly and kind of clear-eyedly on a joint project with someone where there's a predictable consequence of that joint project that you will have to do a particular thing, or that someone else will have to do a particular thing to you. So if you kind of embark on a joint project with someone, knowing that at some point they'll have to kind of take some of your property or kind of, you know, encroach on your space in various sorts of ways, then by embarking on the joint project, as long as it was predictable that something like this would happen, you thereby give consent. And Munoz and Baron Smith think that something like that's going on in the case of consenting to waiving rights against yourself. And I think you might think something like that is pretty plausible for synchronic cases, although it's kind of peculiar thing to think about, that I'm kind of embarked on a joint project with myself. But you can sort of, I think, get yourself into the mindset of thinking this. The problem is it's not at all obvious that you can do something like that with kind of across any kind of period of time. It's not at all obvious that I can embark on a joint project with myself tomorrow, for instance. Not least because myself tomorrow isn't around. There's a kind of important sense in which they're not there. And we'll come back to this when we talk about, in a sec now, in fact, when I talk about Christine Krogsgaard's argument for unity of agents. Okay, so you might worry about that. You might think that, in fact, I don't embark on a joint project with myself tomorrow when I do certain things that will have effects on them. When I do things today that will have effects on them. And so I'm not really embarking on a joint project in the way that would end up giving the right sort of consent. So if I book a root canal treatment for tomorrow, and I'm not really kind of embarking on that joint project of getting my teeth sorted with my tomorrow self, because they're not around. But you might think we can appeal to something like Christine Korsgaard's notion of kind of the unity of agency across time in order to avoid them. So I should say that the use I'm trying to make of Korsgaard here, I don't think it's successful, as I'll explain. But I don't think what I'm going to say goes against any of the uses that Korsgaard herself is putting this idea to. I'm using it to try to kind of understand what's going on with the Munoz and Baron Smith. I'll make an objection to it, but I don't think it's an objection to what Korsgaard's trying to do in that paper. I don't agree with what he's trying to do in that paper, but not necessarily for these reasons. Okay, so this is one of the kind of early responses to Parfit. So Korsgaard's kind of, first of all, in that paper she'd been talking about the unity of agency at a particular time. How can we think of ourselves as kind of unified agents when there's kind of all these incursions of different urges and desires and clashing projects and so on a person at a given time. But now she's thinking of the diachronic. And suppose Parfit has established that there's no deep sense in which I am identical to the subject of experiences who will occupy my body in the future, so that I'm not necessarily the same in any important sense or part of the same entity that will be myself in the future. I will argue that I nevertheless have reasons for regarding myself as the same rational agent as that subject. And this is a kind of an interesting feature of this, is partly why I don't think that anything I'll say goes against what Korsgaard's wanting to do here. Because what she's trying to argue for is that there's a particular way you have to regard yourself, not necessarily a particular way that you in fact are. Of course, we're in Kantian territory, so a kind of transcendental argument might move you from that kind of necessity of regarding yourself in a particular way to something like a conclusion about how you are. But that's not where we are at the moment. So suppose that a succession of rational agents do occupy my body, these different selves. I, the one who exists now, need the cooperation of the others, and they need mine, if together we are going to have any kind of a life. The unity of our life is forced upon us, although not deeply, by our shared embodiment, together with our desire to carry on long-term plans and relationships. In order to make deliberate choices, your present self must identify with something from which you will derive your reasons, but not necessarily with something present. The thing you identify yourself with may carry you automatically into the future. I've been suggesting that this very likely will be the case. So the chorus guards here suggesting you have to consider yourself as an agent, because that's the only way in which you can kind of get reasons in order, the right sorts of reasons to carry out the project, the actions you'll do now as part of the projects that you have for your whole life. So the point I want to make here is I don't think a novel point, and in some ways Korsgaard herself is perfectly aware of it, that everything that she says there can also be said about kind of groups of individuals and the people with whom we're kind of closely related within our lives. If we're going to kind of live a kind of joint or shared life together, we also need one another's cooperation. And just as, you know, my current self now and my future self share this particular body and as a result are kind of thrown together in some way, she says, not deeply, but this kind of shared embodiment. Nonetheless, similarly, I and the kind of people that I, you know, share my life with and build my life with are also sort of thrown together in a geographical space that we have to share, and as a result are kind of put into relations with one another, which requires that we need this kind of cooperation. Okay, so Korsgaard is aware of this kind of response. So she accepts that kind of analogy between the relationship between ourselves and the person we are and the relationship between those that are subject to a state's authority and the state itself. So she thinks that this is kind of right, though in fact there are other sorts of collections of entities that are kind of grouped together and have the same sorts of relations that selves have with respect to the person. And these could be, for instance, people are subject to a state's authority and the state itself. She says, we have a state only when these citizens have constituted themselves into a single agent. They have, that is, adopted a way of resolving conflicts, making decisions, interacting with other states, and planning together for an ongoing future. So she thinks, yes, that's absolutely right. There are other things that you might call collective agents, just as there are persons who she thinks of as these kind of extended agents. But she thinks that that can only happen if you have this kind of situation that she's talking about, where people have kind of interacted and adopted a way of resolving conflicts, making decisions, and so on. But here comes the point where it becomes important that the future selves or the other selves of mine are not around at the same time as my current self. The citizens of, or not necessarily just the citizens, but those subject to the state's authority, if they're kind of going to be subject to the state's authority at a particular time, the state gets that legitimacy only if that group of people has been kind of around and able to come up with these together. Of course, actual situations don't have this kind of full consent view of kind of state legitimacy. But something like that's the sort of ideal, but that ideal can't even be approximated in the case of selves. They're just not existing together in order to make these kind of decisions together. And so it looks like you can't draw on this in order to say that a self now, my current self, is able to make decisions that will end up kind of burdening future selves. A state where people have kind of come together to make decisions about how decision-making will happen is able to make certain decisions that will benefit some and trade off benefits to some against burdens to others. And that's legitimate because everyone's kind of come together to decide on how that would be done. That's not going to be the case for the case of the person. So I don't think that's going to work too much. Okay, so that's the kind of worry I think about this view that says something like you in fact have this exactly the same, or perhaps very similar duties to others that you have, duties to yourself as you have to others, but the reason we have this kind of asymmetry between the intrapersonal and the interpersonal is because it's kind of more possible for you to or more likely, at least, or more often the case, that you will have kind of waived the rights that you have against yourself than it is that you've waived the rights against others, or others have waived their rights against you. So I don't think that's going to be the case. I think it may be able to work in the synchronic case, where the kind of a burden that you're imposing is on yourself right now as the action happens, or perhaps over some short extended time. But it doesn't seem to be possible to do it in ways that can kind of end up burdening yourself. power in the future. And nonetheless, we do seem to think, while I was saying that there are going to be cases in which you can morally wrong yourself by burdening yourself in the far future, there are also going to be cases where it's okay to burden yourself. You know, we don't think there's anything kind of morally wrong with certain sorts of burdening in the far future. There's severe cases like these extreme sports that I was talking about, where you do wrong yourself by that. But there's other cases in which it's okay to burden yourself to some extent in the far future. And it's not at all clear how a view based on something like the Munoz and Baron Schmidt view, perhaps plus a Korsgaard understanding of agency, could give us that. Okay, so let's move to the alternative, which is there's no duties to yourself, and so there's no need for release. But nonetheless, there are other ways in which you can behave immorally towards yourself that are not violations of duties. Okay, so for this I'm going to draw on Jarvis Thompson's famous discussion of the unconscious violinist case in her case of defense of abortion. So here's her line. I mean, I think this is one of these cases that, you know, most people will know, but I think there's actually a part of her judgment about it that's less often discussed, and I think might give a kind of possibility here, but I think in the end perhaps it doesn't fully answer our question. Okay, so this is the original case, just to remind people of it. You wake up in the morning, you find yourself back to back in bed with a famous unconscious violinist. He's been found to have a fatal kidney ailment, and the Society of Music Lovers has canvassed all the available medical records and found that you alone have the right blood type to have. They therefore kidnapped you, and last night the violinist's circulatory system was plugged into yours so that your kidneys can be used to extract poisons from his blood as well as your own. The director of the hospital now tells you, look, we're very sorry that the Society of Music Lovers did this to you. We would never have permitted it if we'd known, but still they did do it, and the violinist is now plugged into you. To unplug you would be to kill him. Never mind, it's only for 9 months. But then he will have recovered from his ailment and can be safely unplugged from you. Is it morally incumbent, this is Jarvis Thompson now, is it morally incumbent on you to accede to this situation? No doubt it would be very nice if you did, a great kindness. But would you? Do you have to accede to it? What she's asking at this point is, do you have a duty to accede to it? Does the violence have a right against you that you must? And her answer is famously no. Thinks that's our natural reaction to it. But she goes on quite a few pages later. So my own view is that even though you ought to let the violinist use your... Sorry, I should say. This is a little bit later, 10 pages later. At this point, she's considering a version of it where it's just for an hour. So the violinist just has to be hooked up to you for an hour. She doesn't think that changes anything about the duties involved. She doesn't think that there's some point of time at which you gain a duty to do this for the violinist. But that doesn't mean, she thinks, and this is the important part, it doesn't mean that there are no moral considerations in this case. Because she doesn't think that the moral considerations are exhausted by what you have a duty to do and what you don't have a duty to do. So she says, I mean, she has this kind of wonderful case of, she's imagining herself having some ailment that can only be cured by Henry Fonda crossing the room and putting his cold hand on her brow. And she says, even that, so this is a case where someone literally has to walk 15 paces across the room and do something. Even in that case, he doesn't have a duty to do it. But she doesn't think that the moral considerations are exhausted by this. She says, so in my view is, even though you ought to let the violinist use your kidneys for the hour, 1 hour he needs, we should not conclude that he has a right to do so. We should say that if you refuse, you are... She has a series of kind of judgments against the person, self-centered, and indecent, in fact, but not unjust, so not violating a right, not violating a duty. The complaints are no less grave, they are just different. So you might think that something like this is going on in the case of future self. So I'll just quickly sketch a kind of analogous case to the violinist case that might inform talk about the future selves, and say I would have a analogous judgment, the Jarvis Thompson judgment about that. Okay, so in the altered case, it's a flautist who's hooked up to you. It's important that a flautist, though, because they're as light as air. This is a feature of flautists. They're light as air, and they're currently unconscious. They're going to remain hooked up to you and unconscious until the day you die, at which point they'll wake up cured, they'll detach themselves from you, and they'll live their lives. But importantly, the quality of the life they'll go on to live will depend on some of the things that you do now in your life. So, for instance, some sort of behaviours that you may well want to engage in, but if you engage in it, then later on, the flot of the wake up is going to have a slightly more miserable life, suffer a little bit more. Okay. So the question is, do you have to refrain from those sorts of behaviour? Do you have any sort of, well, two questions. It would be morally wrong for you to engage in those behaviours that will end up having this effect. Secondly, do you have a duty not to? Does the philosophers have a right against you not to? So you might, by analogy with the Jarvis Thompson case, say no duty. But again, by analogy, you might say that nonetheless morality places demands on your treatment of it. You might think, yes, it would be, you know, in Jarvis Thompson's case, words, self-centered and callous and decent, in fact, but not themselves. So again, this would give a kind of explanation of this asymmetry between the intrapersonal and the interpersonal, because in the interpersonal case, we do have a duty not to do certain things that will predictably make somebody suffer, actively do something that will end up kind of making someone else. But in the case of the philosophers, we don't have that duty, but it may nonetheless be kind of morally bad for other sorts of reasons. So you might think that the reason for the asymmetry is just that there's different sorts of things, considerations that go into the moral facts. Some of them are duties, but they're just absent in the cases. So you have no duties to your future selves. You do nonetheless, there are nonetheless moral demands on them. You have duties and these other sources of moral demands in your behaviour towards other people. That gives rise to it. So what is the source of the analogy, if we think that there is any sort of analogy here? So in both of these cases, and I take it in some ways this is what's really behind, an interesting case, the Jarvis Thompson case, I think, and interesting, I think, that our reactions are the way they are. Right? So I think one thing that's absolutely crucial to it, this is also present in the Flotus case, is that you have not chosen to be in the position in which your actions have the effect they will have. In fact, Jarvis Thompson has this kind of interesting sort of sets of arguments where she kind of relaxes that, where you kind of have made decisions that, you know, could, you know, with some chance have given rise to this and so on. So there's questions about whether this is absolutely essential to the case. But in the case, the two cases I've described, at least, you have not chosen to be in that position. But one thing that is interesting about it is that in both cases, the thing that you are kind of okay to do is, in some way, is a kind of genuinely positive action. It's unplugging the person in the violinist case, and it's, you know, doing whatever these behaviours are that will be detrimental to the flautist in the flautist case. Because I think a natural reaction is this is something like, well, in the kind of violinist case, it's a kind of lack of kind of positive action. It's just a kind of letting something happen that would otherwise. But that's not really the case here. You're actively doing something. You're actively changing a kind of aspect of things. You're doing the unplugging. Okay. And I think in both of the cases, so this is definitely more speculative and controversial, our reaction stems in part from the sense that your duties here would impose a kind of substantial constraint on your freedom. And this is somewhat suspect because in the case that Jarvis Thompson talks about with kind of Henry Fonda crossing the room, or the 1 hour back-to-back of the person is not imposing a kind of substantial constraint on your freedom. And nonetheless, we don't think that there are duties there, in any case. Okay, so you might think that by analogy with the Flotus case, just as you don't have duties to the Flotus, you don't have duties to your future selves. But nonetheless, that interpersonal morality has this. Is underpinned by these other considerations, the kind of selfishness, the callousness, the kind of the moral wrongs that come about by being those things in your action. But I don't actually necessarily think that this is the wrong account. I think that the problem with it is it still remains a mystery why there is this difference between the two sorts of cases. Because it's very hard to see exactly what is different about the Flotus case and just our general interactions with one another in life. It's also the case that I didn't choose to be in a causal nexus that makes certain things I do have certain kind of bad effects on people that I interact with. But nonetheless, I'm here, I'm in it, and in fact, I do have moral requirements not to behave in certain ways. You know, there are certain things, you know, like pouring poison into a glass or something like that. I didn't choose to be in a world where this particular substance in my hand was poison, but given that I was, I have a obligation not to do that sort of thing. So one problem here is it's just very hard to separate out the kind of causal links or the chosenness of the thing to separate out these two cases. So in some ways, you might want something a little bit more fundamental here. Okay, so here's something of a attempt to sketch something like this. So I think certainly my experience of talking about this topic with people is when you mention that you're thinking about kind of duties to self, as one person put it when I started talking to her about it, she said, oh God, that would just be so exhausting. I'm already thinking about all these kind of duties I have to other people. And that's, it's places a lot of demands on me, but I'm happy to because they seem like important other people. But now I also have to consider all these kind of other parts of myself. I thought that was one domain in which I was safe. And I think there's actually, so I think it's a sort of deep truth to that, that what people feel is that certainly, suppose you were in a situation where you really did have exactly the same duties to yourself that you have to others, and that it really was quite tricky to waive them when the others who will be affected were sort of, some distance down in the future, sort of maybe a week, maybe a month, maybe 6 months. In that kind of case, it would very severely limit your freedom. You might end up thinking that is very troubling. Okay, so this is the hypothesis. The heart of the reaction to the violinist case and the flautist case is the judgment there's a kind of sphere of influence over which a person has primary jurisdiction, their dominion, and they get to say what goes on within it, up to a point. So this is not going to become a kind of Nozick-style absolutist version of self-ownership. But I think there is a sense in which that's something of our reaction. That when you have these kind of, when we talk about these cases in which you end up violating these duties to yourself, so the cases like these extreme sports and other sorts of things, you sort of think something like, I have to try to live my life, and I have to, in order to kind of live my life and pursue certain of my projects, that's going to end up doing things that perhaps future parts of myself will not approve of. But the only way in which I can get a certain sort of value is by having the ability to use, say, the body particularly that I inhabit for certain sorts of, in freely for certain sorts of purposes. So many of the projects that we pursue, Korsgaard has this line, which is obviously right about, that in order to pursue certain long-term goals you have, she says you need the cooperation of others, and in particular your own past and future selves in order to live a certain sort of life. But you don't just need that sort of cooperation. You also need a kind of lack of active intervention or prevention of you pursuing these goals. And so what you end up needing is some sort of system that ensures that you have this if you're going to get the sorts of goods that you you can get if you have some jurisdiction over, say, the body that you inhabit. But that, moreover, other cells will also inhabit, and so whatever you do with it will have some effect on the body that they will end up inhabiting. And so it looks like what we need in the end is some sort of justification of some very, very minimal institution of private property. So I'm not here talking about the kind of institution of private property that, for instance, Nozick was interested in justifying, or even the kind of ones that were being justified by, say, Locke and so on, where you're not just thinking of the kind of use of your body, but also, say, the use of anything that you can create as a result of using it in particular ways, and then with questions of sort of appropriation of non-person resources. I'm just interested in a kind of very minimal constraint where you have a certain amount of jurisdiction to use the body that you've been given to pursue your own ends. Okay, and so what are the sorts of justifications that are given for any sort of institution of private property? Well, one natural one is a kind of instrumental one. It's sort of the one that I've been sketching out. That either you think that it's the best system that will enable people to realise certain sorts of value? Or you think there's certain sorts of value that can only be realised by having something like this sort of control over your body? So Hegel has some sort of view that's a little, and Jeremy Waldron has some certain sort of view that's a little bit like the latter, where it's in fact a necessary condition on you, for instance, developing certain sorts of autonomous behaviour or exercising your freedom to have an ability to kind of use your own body in a particular way. But you might not take it strongly as that. You might not think that it's all about, that the argument concerns a necessity. You might just think the best system of rules that we could have that would end up kind of allowing for the kind of greatest kind of realization of value is for people to have a certain amount of jurisdiction over your current self, to have a certain amount of jurisdiction over the body that they inhabit, even if that means using that body in a way that when it comes to be inhabited later on by one of the later selves is going to end up kind of causing some suffering for those later selves. But, and this is kind of typical of these instrumental or kind of consequentialist arguments, but there's going to be limits on that, because it's going to turn out that the best system, the system that kind of best realizes the kind of the balance of getting these goods, but also avoiding people kind of suffering too much, is going to be one that puts some limits on how you can use it. So it's not okay to use the body that you have in such a way that when it comes to be later on inhabited by someone else, it involves enormous suffering over a long period of time. That's the sort of thing that these rules would prohibit. But they would nonetheless permit something that does impose some sort of suffering, because that's the that in the end is the best system of rules for balancing out the possibility of getting goods and the possibility of getting these bad consequences. So I think something like this is has got to be at play. One reason to think that something like this is what's going on is that our judgments about these cases are not absolutist. We don't have this sense. I mean, so Nozick has this kind of view that you just have complete self-ownership, and so at any particular time you can really just do whatever you like with your own body. That just doesn't seem to match up with the intuitions we have, but there really are things that we can do that will end up kind of affecting ourselves in the future in such a way that they end up just being wrong. You don't have that kind of absolute you don't have absolute property rights currently over the body that will end up kind of being inhabited later on by others. But you do have some, and you have some more rights over this body than you certainly do over the bodies of others. Okay. So that's the sort of, I think, at least the beginnings of an account of explaining this puzzle, that there are demands that intrapersonal morality places on us. Not okay to kind of just behave towards yourself in any way whatsoever. But those demands go a little bit beyond just not violating the kind of unwaivable duties that Alison talks about. There are other ways in which the things that intrapersonal morality forbids that are not just violations of these unwaivable duties. But nonetheless, these demands are weaker than the demands that morality places on our interactions with others. Thanks very much.
As usual, just 2 or 3 minutes for people to leave, and we'll go on till 6:30. I'm not going to look at questions.
See you later.
At all.
Yeah, it also all connects.
See you later, Chris.
Okay, now you can put your hands up. Start with offer.
Thanks, Richard. I wanted to ask about the positive account at the end, and I was just wondering, is there really a disanalogy here between duties to our future selves and duties to others? I mean, if I start, you know, I have all these projects that I want to pursue, and if I start to think about the consequences they have to all, you know, and pursuing them rather than saving drowning children, and, you know, I'm sort of neglecting all these duties to other people, and if I start taking them seriously, it would be really detrimental to these duties to others. So I'm just kind of worried that you'll end up with exactly the same sorts of considerations.
That it will end up being, the sort of account will make... That it won't be any more demanding. Your treatment of others won't be any more demanding. It will just and the reason is that so. So I think, I mean, the reason I was thinking it ends up being less demanding So I take it some of the reasons people give for why you don't have a duty in all, in sort of these duties of, you don't have full duties of kind of beneficence that you can end up, you know, using some of your resources or time or whatever to pursue your own projects rather than, you know, saving lives that you could save, or improving lives that you could save by using money, is something like this sort of argument. That by doing so, I mean, this is sort of the, I mean, it's not the Williams argument. It's kind of interesting that it's not the Williams, because it sort of points in the direction of what Williams says, that, you know, you would, a problem with these very demanding views is that you might end up with a situation in which nobody's really able to pursue anything, any of the things that end up kind of giving positive value, that everyone's sort of looking to do things for other and not pursuing some of their own duties. I mean, I'm actually on record of thinking that we should do a lot more of that. We do have stronger duties of beneficence than a lot of people argue we do, but I suppose I was just thinking that in
I'm just thinking, it's not just drowning children, right? Sometimes pushing someone to get to the front of the queue would really help me to pursue my project, and it's not a huge harm to them. But
I see. Okay. Right, but I take it in those kind of cases. I mean, the whole account is sort of rule consequential to some extent, and I take it in those kind of cases. Those are, I mean, yeah, they're kind of interesting cases, but where they follow from rules that, you know, perhaps in that one-off situation would end up being okay, but, you know, in total it's kind of better to end up having these kind of general rules in place, because in fact if you didn't have them, then people would kind of be less, you know, they're kind of, if you didn't have rules or anything like that, it would just be the kind of constant carnage and melee of people kind of constantly, you know, there's a kind of advantage to everyone of having a certain sort of order. In those kind of cases, that it creates a certain kind of way of thinking about it. All those kind of usual sorts of arguments. But I think the way I was thinking about it is that there's this a set of rules that tells you that it's kind of it's okay to kind of burden future selves in order to kind of pursue some of your projects in ways not okay to burden others, gives the kind of right balance of creating space. So why, I suppose one question would be, why is there this kind of disanalogy between the two? Why is there this asymmetry between the two cases? Why is it that kind of the set of rules that allows me to kind of use my own body in a particular way is kind of better? But that, I think that's something to do with, maybe this is a kind of worrying feature of it, because some of these sort of things that we kind of hold to be very deep moral facts end up having some contingency about the sorts of projects that we have. But the sort of projects we have kind of are exactly the sorts of things that will end up kind of, you know, using our own kind of body in a particular way. And then you might worry that, well, in another sort of situation where we end up having different projects, this is all going to end up kind of being different, and that's kind of troubling. Yeah, I think that's something we'd have to think about. But the general thought was that, in fact, the thing that is going to, the kind of set of rules that's going to end up allowing us to kind of strike the right balance between creating value and people being able to kind of live valuable lives, and not be kind of constantly interrupted in the service of kind of watching out for their future self. The right way to do that is something like the kind of system that we've kind of internalized. Yeah, I feel like that hasn't properly answered it. We have to think about that more.
Andreas.
Yeah, thanks. I was wondering what you think about the following sort of case, a bit more outlandish, but imagine a case involving time travel. I travel back in time, I could torture one of two people, either my past self or my twin brother. This is a sort of case where I might think the kind of self-other symmetry, I mean, it's hard to know what to say, but it feels kind of plausible about these cases that in some sense, you know, it would be as wrong of me to torture myself as to torture my past twin brother or something like that. I mean, yeah, I don't know that that's really an obligatory thing, but it's certainly a kind of judgment about that case that seems very reasonable and might suggest that something like this self-other symmetry really is true. We just really need to exercise our imagination to really put oneself in relation to oneself in the same way one ordinarily relates to others.
So, in that sort of case, why, I'm wondering why the direction of time ends up being, maybe this is exactly your question, so in the future directed thing, I think we take away to make the judgment that's not that symmetry that, you know, we have obligations not to do that to anyone, but certain sort of imposing some sort of burden on future self is kind of sometimes okay, that it wouldn't be okay to burden someone else. So in that sort of case where I'm kind of burdening the past self, I mean, one thing I think that's tricky, and maybe in the end I don't have to worry too much about my answer to this, because if the view is something like, what's the system of rules such that were it to be kind of internalized and kind of rule our society would end up kind of giving rise to the best outcomes, it's kind of fine, given that we can't travel back in time. So what the rules say about that will end up having no effect on this sort of thing. So I might not have to worry too much about that, but I think when I think of it in terms of, I think if it's torture, then I agree, because it's just wrong to do that to anyone, regardless of whether it's you or someone else. If it's something less than torture, it's a kind of, you know, a bad burden, but something less than that. I don't know how much I should rely on these intuitions, but I do feel like there's something kind of better about doing it to the kind of past self. But I suspect that's just piggybacking on what I think about other kind of cases. I sort of, in that case, I kind of go back and I think, well, who will be the person who'll kind of have to later on, well, it's going to be me, so it's kind of fine to do it to myself, to my twin brother, that's not okay. But yes, I think, I mean, it's an interesting feature of these, this kind of a approach, I think, to thinking about the kind of moral facts, where you think it's something like, what's the kind of system such that we're kind of internalized and acted upon, end up having the kind of best kind of realized value or balance, the kind of value against disvalue, but that a lot of outlandish cases it can not worry too much about, because in fact those will end up not occurring.
Thanks. I wanted to ask a bit about Course Guard and the state, and then I guess sort of more generally about the metaphysics and the normativity.
Yeah, right.
So on the, you said the state analogy didn't work because in the case of a nation, the citizens exist together and have agreed about the way that they're administered, but future selves are not present. And there's an obvious way that that isn't right, because what the state decides binds the state in the future, and new people will join. So in terms of the people, you know, they're agreeing at a moment, but they're binding the state for the future. And then, like, there's a big question about how we should understand how that's possible. And here are these sort of two possible different moves. One, I think, is more similar to your answer than the other, I think, you're looking at. So one is to say, well, if you weren't able to make, say, a law that binds the future, this would be, like, chaotic. You couldn't make treaties, it would just, like... So for consequentialist-type reasons, we have to sort of pretend that we can do this. The other way would say, well, no, there's the state. And that's an entity that exists through time. So when the state makes a treaty, even though people come in and out, it's bound itself into the future.
Right.
So what's going on in the personal cases is not, well, there's myself, and then there's this future self, which is this other self. But I turn into the future self. I have bound myself in the future. So that's the difference. So whether you understand that in a normative way or not, no, but that seems to be an alternative.
Yeah, so I think that's right. One reason I think that's actually, in some ways, I think that's quite a helpful way of looking at it to understand what I think's wrong with that in the person kind of case. Because, so you mentioned one thing that states can do is something like treaties. Now, as we've recently had evidence, states can very quickly decide on a week-by-week basis whether they're continuing to honour treaties. Now, you might think it's a kind of matter of, a kind of consequentialist justification that there's a consequentialist justification for having much more stable, you know, kind of witnessing what happens when states don't behave stably in those kind of respects. But I think... Yeah, there's a case for saying that the treaties that are valid end up being valid exactly because the state could at any particular time kind of withdraw from it. And of course there's this kind of, you know, practical limitation on how often you can kind of go back to the people who are affected by it to kind of ask them. But and whether they do, but they get their legitimacy because if the state doesn't withdraw from them, they're kind of, in a sense, kind of continuing to.
So they're bound, even though there's different people who are bound.
Right, but those different people could, you know, they're kind of, in a sense, they are consenting. They're consenting exactly by. The state, the people that they're electing, not withdrawing from the treaties. That's what I was thinking. That it,
isn't that like your? Sorry, but this, you thought that I could do that with myself as long as I was present, but I couldn't with my future self. But right, can't I do it until such a time as, you know, I bind myself until I change my mind?
Yeah, I think you can do that with kind of long term sort of plans. The worry is about doing things now that kind of then go out of your control and end up burdening you later on. So not ones where you're kind of continuing to kind of be engaged in a relationship, say, or kind of uphold a commitment until you kind of back out of it. I was more thinking of things where... So one thing I think we would really worry about a state now doing is something that would end up kind of... Which we do, in fact, think in the climate case and use of fossil fuels and so on, is doing things now that would end up kind of burdening, you know, making the choice... Now to burden future generations when they're not around to consent to. They're not around in order to kind of determine the decision making procedures that would end up kind of having this kind of detrimental effect on them. And that's why I think the sort of treaties cases if you're entering into treaties that would end up being kind of very burdensome to future generations, then yeah, you might think that that's not actually something that states should, in fact, enter into. I mean, it's tricky because, in fact, states do something like this, but exactly people's complaints about some of the kind of use of fossil fuels and something like this. Yeah.
This is partly from Kantian background, yeah. Thinking about some of this. So I'm guessing you were talking about the demands of interpersonal morality being weaker.
Yeah.
But at least the way Kant introduces it, some of them are meant to be stronger. So duties to oneself in terms of developing one's talents and so on. And there's this weird comment in the Metaphysics of Morals where it says, without duties to the self, there'd be no external duties.
That's right,
So I wanted to know whether you were happy to allow that duties to the self can be stronger in some cases to duties to others and how that fits in to this framework.
So I think I don't agree with that. I certainly don't... I think there's an interesting... Of course, Kant isn't really thinking this, but there's an interesting split, I think, between cases in historical literature where people think the duties to self somehow come from an obligation you have, not necessarily to a creator, but somehow to that arise from having been bequeathed a certain sort of gift, something, you know, the gift of being alive and inhabiting, and as a result of having received this benefit, obligations are created on you to say use it to the best of your abilities. That's the sort of nurturing talent sort of case, or the case where people think that you have a kind of duty to treat yourself with a certain sort of dignity or something like that. There's a sort of a sense in which the duty is not necessarily to an external force like a creator, but there's a sort of duty to the kind of impersonal world that has kind of given you this, and you're sort of not doing what you owe to yourself if you don't make the most of that. I'm thinking about something like the talents. I think that the other kind of case where, actually this is more similar to the talents case, a little bit like the talents case, where Kant thinks that you have an obligation to kind of make yourself, kind of improve yourself morally, in some sense, because you then have a duty to be moral, and someone who doesn't kind of develop their moral talents as well as their kind of other sorts of talents is doing. Right. There, I think you can kind of justify that on indirect. You have a duty to do that because you have a duty to, in fact, treat people well, and this is the kind of best kind of way to do that. Cases where you think that there's a kind of primary duty as to yourself, I think I just disagree with Kant on that kind of case. But I think the duties to kind of develop talents, I just think are not there. There's a sense in which you might think there are duties to put your later self in certain positions to be able to do things. So someone, say, who does nothing to kind of prepare themselves for choices that they'll later have, so essentially end up closing off options for their future selves by not developing talent. That sort of thing, I think, you could end up in this framework. Accounting for, because what they're doing there is somehow limiting the future self's autonomy by shrinking their option set in some ways. But that seems a little bit different from the idea that you've, given a particular talent, you have some obligation to nurture that talent. You might have an obligation to do that if, by not doing that, that really closes down lots of options such that you're kind of left with ones that are poor in some sort of way. But I think that's different. The very demanding version that Kant's requiring of us, I think, as always, is sort of requiring something very strong.
I just wanted to ask Richard about the asymmetry that you're suggesting here. And I was thinking, if selves over a period of time do inhabit different points of view, then they could be so different that we could call them different selves. Mm-hmm. And, that's the kind of thing I think Parfit has in mind when he's talking about. And so if they're different selves, then that's what they're denying. If, by examples like vision, replication, a twin Richard at a later time, who could write the book that you, really want to, you can go off on holiday, whatever, because you've changed it.
Yeah.
that what they want to deny is the asymmetry that you want. So you kind of said, I want to go along those lines, and then I wasn't sure whether you really want to go along those lines to deny. Is someone like you, you know, is all they need.
Right.
Parfit finds death liberating because someone like him, as long as there's someone like him who can carry on his project.
Yes, and I think the kind of account I give was going to allow that. So this kind of, as long as the, yeah. Yes. So as long as your project is in some ways impersonally stated. I mean, this is a difficulty where the metaphysics might end up featuring within the statement of the project, right? So what you might really want is that you write that book, not the book to be written. And you might have a very particular kind of account of what it means for it to be you who wrote it. And you might kind of attach value to that. I think I'm humane enough about kind of preferences that people really, even if these things don't really exist, even if we don't actually, in our final metaphysics, want to say that there are something like enduring persons, or that they, whatever they are, they don't have the same pattern as this person's kind of pattern of care about them. I think it'd be perfectly fine for someone to have that as a goal, and it could end up be a valuable one for them to pursue, that it genuinely be them that do that sort of thing. But if someone just has the kind of value that someone that the book be written, that the kind of book carry on, then yes, that's going to be for that current self. Would be just as good at that it be the person like them that writes, or maybe that's what their preference is, that someone like them writes, not just that the book be written, but someone. So I think our preferences can be kind of fine-grained. Can be kind of specified in part by our account of, you know, of persons, ourselves, or identity. But I, so in some ways, I don't want to deny. I mean, I take it as sort of the picture in the end is a little bit like Parfit's, but I think where it really differs is that Parfit assumes. So Parfit assumes that how we care about persons at other times or other selves is correlated with this kind of, you know, the connection, the psychological connectedness. And I just don't think that's true. Some people will care in those senses, some people will care in completely different senses, some people will take this kind of Strominger and Sean Nichols idea that you know, it's really me if they have the same morality as me, but everything else doesn't matter. Others will have different sorts of things, and they will care along these different. So I think Parfit, in some ways, is interested in what you care about. I know he does also have some of this stuff about what kind of morality might require of you. But I think really what he's interested in is how you kind of persuade people using their actual patterns of caring about others to see that in fact they should be altruistic. Because in fact, if you reason through what your patterns of caring are, you care just as much about others more psychologically connected to you as you do about others. And that's a kind of persuasive technique to get people to be more altruistic. But I don't think it's a kind of account in the end of the kind of morality of how these selves should treat each other. So I started off thinking this was a sort of an attempt something like vindicate the Parfit project, and ended up thinking it's actually just a very different thing, that he's thinking he's going to take actual psychological facts about people and how they care about things and try to use philosophical arguments to say that if you are consistent in those patterns of caring, then you should be more altruistic. This is a slightly different kind of project, I think, where it's trying to just say whatever your patterns of caring are about other selves, then there's these kind of arguments that suggest that, you know, you in fact have moral duties, or there are moral demands on how you treat other selves that are part of you as a person. They're different from treating others. Yeah.
Thank you. I was wondering whether there's a different way of using the observation about joint projects to help sort of support the Munoz Baron-Schmidt view. Well, the idea would be, look, we just observed that as a matter of fact, by engaging in a project, I can consent to my future self doing the things necessary, or being subjected to the relevant things necessary. I don't know how that happens, but here's an argument that it does happen. Suppose you and I make a plan And it involves me passing out at some point and you drawing a funny mustache on my face, which you wouldn't normally be allowed to do, but here we go, we make this plan together. And now I have, in fact, consented to you doing that to my future self. It's not because the future self was there in the decision. Who knows how it happened?
Yeah.
But it did, in fact, happen. Otherwise, you would be wronging me
when you
draw on my face, and you're clearly not.
Yeah.
And so, sort of, we can sort of take the observation about the consent being effective without having to think, or without, you know, that can just be our sort of starting point for the account, and then digging into how or why that is, interesting question, but since it's so clear that it does in fact happen, we'll have to answer it.
Yeah, so I think what's troubling about that kind of thing is it doesn't, that same, I mean, you might think this is just wrong, but that same claim doesn't seem to work if you're separated in time by too much. So it seems right if, you know, we make a plan now to kind of go out, drink a lot, and then, you know, if you pass out, then, you know, that's gonna, you really want us by the end of the evening to have a mustache on your face. Absolutely right. No, it's because it's in the next 12 hours or something like that. That, I mean, for something reasonably minor like that, you might think that's also fine, sort of 20 years down the line. But you might not, right? And I do think that in very slightly more serious cases where so people worry about this, for instance, say with advanced directives, definitely more serious cases. The distance in time, so that someone's kind of consent at a particular time. That seems sort of right. I mean, I think these cases are sort of tricky because it's difficult to come up with a non-contrived case where you don't think that what's happened is that the person's kind of implicitly continued to consent by not withdrawing their consent during the time. You know, so if I say to you now, you know, in 20 years' time, you can kind of come and take whatever car I own at that time and kind of drive off with it. Why is that? Is it some sense we want to say, well, maybe that's not so bad, but maybe that's just because by me never at any point kind of withdrawing my consent from that. But I do think there's something kind of troubling if what you do in 20 years' time is just come and without asking. And without, we've been completely out of touch for the intermittent 20 years. There's been no possibility of me communicating to you my withdrawal of the consent. Then at that time, you're just kind of coming and kind of taking it. The natural thing is that you ask the person, and why? Well, that might not be because it would be morally wrong for you to do it, but just because there's kind of norms of just being a decent person and kind of, you know. I think there is just a stronger sense in which consent over that kind of period just doesn't seem to be effective. Sexual consent cases are very like this, I think, that you really don't want to say that consent at one point kind of binds the person kind of later down the line. So in some ways I agree. I think there are cases, but this is a real puzzle about, I think, about all of this, is that consent has a sort of strange effect when what you're consenting to is something that's detrimental to you quite a lot further down the line.
So I think we have to stop there. But we should thank Richard, not just for this lecture today, but for a wonderful series. And it's really, I mean, a testament to how wonderful it is that it's such a big audience at the end. It's unusual for a lecture. So thank you very much.